Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome your Studcast host of television and radio fame, Tony Basilio.
96 years, four generations. It is show 21. It is time to saddle up. It is time to ride with your Tennessee Stud, Tony Basilio, welcoming you to another edition of your Studcast. And if you joined us last week on the show, you know that this week's program is going to be a very special edition of the Studcast. Why? Because we're going to take you around the world. Now, I told the Stud last time, I still wanted him to get into a couple of the names that he teased in our last episode. Specifically, I wanted him to talk about Bob Armstrong turning pro back in 64. But Stud, all of a sudden, we're in 1965, and my man, it's another action-packed episode.
Yes, it is. My pleasure to be here. I hope they're all going to be action-packed episodes. I'm doing my best, and I know you are as well, to fill this up as we can. The time goes by really fast, faster than I can ever imagine. I think last week at the end of that program, you said, you know, Ron, we're past an hour here and just about out of time. And I was like, I'm thinking we're 20 minutes in. It's just like it just zooms by. So, you know, let's jump right into it. You want to do is jump right into it. Let's get into it. You want to talk Bob Armstrong. There is a tremendous individual right there. Bob Armstrong, the first time I ever saw Bob Armstrong wrestle, I was 15 years old, and he was a fireman. He came with a fireman's background. He had been a fireman for I don't know how many years. I never discussed that with Bob, exactly how many years he was a fireman before he became a wrestler. But he had another fireman named Daryl Cochran, and Daryl Cochran taught Bob enough wrestling to get him started as a wrestler. Now, Daryl Cochran's a great individual, wonderful guy. I was friends with Daryl Cochran, obviously, as well as Bob, but not nearly so close to him as I was Bob. But Daryl had a great body, and he helped Bob develop his great body. And Bob's got one of the best bodies ever been on a wrestler. And Bob just was a wonderful, from the very beginning, he's one of those guys that you could tell, even though he was a rookie in his first or second year, that this guy's going places. He's going to be a big star. And nobody probably went further than Bob Armstrong, in my opinion. He was a star everywhere he ever went. And not just a star, but a great individual, too. And it was wonderful watching him as a young man and saying to myself, boy, I want to do what he can do. I had no idea that I was going to wrestle that guy probably 1,000 times. It seems like I probably did.
Amazing. I mean, and who would have known that? And how would you have known that? Young Bob Armstrong, what kind of worker was he? What are your early memories of him?
One word, fire. Bob Armstrong had so much fire, and he still got it. He's still in the ring. That tells you a lot about him right there. He's well into his 70s. He's still in the ring, and he's still got that fire. And that's what people want. That's what fans want. When it comes time for you to do your thing, they want to feel it. Some guys just have the ability to put it out there and then portray it and to make them see it. And some guys don't. Some guys never grasp it. But Bob Armstrong grasped it at a very young age. And without much experience, he started becoming a star in Georgia in the 70s. Long before I ever started wrestling, he was becoming a star already. Some guys have it, some guys don't. To me, it's one word, it's fire. You got that fire, you're going to get the fans.
Stud, you got that fire and you're getting the fans. You got a comment of the week. We start each show with this. Chris Stewart out of Indianapolis says the following. And Chris, thank you for being there. Chris Stewart says, lots of wrestling-related podcasts to choose from, but I never fail to saddle up and take the ride each week. So long as you continue to let us sit under your learning tree, I'll be listening in earnest. And Chris Stewart, those are great thoughts. Now, Stud, speaking of the learning tree, you promised when we left in our last episode that went a little long for my taste. But you promised, Stud, that you would, until this Patreon thing picks up, Stud, that thing went a little long. We'll talk more about that later on, Stud, if you know what I mean. I'm appealing for the money here early on, Stud. You like it?
Well, now there is a setup. If you like what we do here and you want this program to stay on the air long enough to hear the entire story of the Welches, one way to do it is to, if you'd like to contribute, support us, and you feel we deserve it, then you can go to Tennessee Stud, TNStud.com, the website, click on donate and make your donation there, or you can go to Patreon, patreon.com/studcast, and make a contribution there. You can contribute as much as you'd like. You can donate as much as you'd like to the cause. I think there's a limit of $5 because there's some expenses that are taken out of that and they require a certain amount. So, you know, it's a $5 minimum donation if you'd like to do that. Or you can donate as much as you want, as often as you want, or you don't have to donate at all. That's the beauty of it, because we're never going to charge for these studcasts. What we do today in these weekly programs are never going to be a charge to these fans, and we'll never have that occur. But if you would like to help us and support us and donate to us, then you're certainly welcome to. That's where you go to do it. And let's jump. Tony, I know how you are, man. You want to roll. I got a lot for today I want to get to. Last week, I didn't get to half of what I wanted to, and we ran long. So I want to jump right into that this week, if that's all right with you. You think so?
Oh, hit it, man.
All right. I want to do what I call the world roundup. I want to take you wrestling around the world. I want to take fans back to 1965. And wherever you are in the world, I'm going to try to touch on you a little bit. There may be some parts of the world I won't get to all of it, but we're going to start first with my family. Let's start with the Welches in 1965. And just a real quick synopsis of where all the Welches are. Now, you still got the Fields boys. They're down there on the Gulf Coast. They have split their territory that originally went from about Tallahassee over to New Orleans and north up to Montgomery. They have split that territory into three pieces, but they are still operating there. They're doing business in Louisiana. They're doing business in Mississippi, Alabama, and in little parts of Florida. Jimmy and Bill Golden. Jimmy Golden, obviously my cousin, one of the great workers of all time, in my opinion, and his dad, Bill Golden, are involved in wrestling. They are working in Louisiana for Lee Fields, one of the Fields brothers. They are handling Alexandria and Monroe, Louisiana. They are in some of these Shreveport. They are in some of these towns in Louisiana, and they are doing business for Lee Fields. Jimmy has not started to wrestle, but he's like Rob and I. He's 15, 14, 15, 16 years old, and he is getting the training. He's already training, but he's just not gotten to that point yet. Roy, my grandfather, still in the business, still in Nashville, still cranking it out, still got a bunch of towns going. He's developing Louisville, Kentucky now, and Evansville, Indiana, and Johnson City and Kingsport, Tennessee. He has regional promoters in Knoxville and John Kazana in Chattanooga, Thornton, Harry Thornton. He has people that send him, he sends talent, they send a payment of a percentage of the gate called a booking fee. He's still cranked. He's still doing very well. Lester, Roy's brother, his youngest brother. Lester has had a run in Nashville now. He's been there consistently for 5 years. He's learned to fly a plane, and he has his own airplane. They are utilizing Lester in a way that's unbelievable. It's very smart for them. They have a lot of TVs, live televisions, so they can't get wrestlers from one side of the state to the other side of the state in time for them to wrestle on two television programs. Lester is a big star, and he also loads this plane with wrestlers, and he flies them from Memphis in the early morning to Knoxville in the afternoon to wrestle on TV in Knoxville, puts them on a plane and flies them to Chattanooga, and they wrestle at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and then they'll wrestle in the live show in the Chattanooga, and then he puts them on a plane and he flies them to Birmingham for midnight live television. So what he's doing is he is making that whole Tennessee territory really cranked, because he's getting these really crucial talent. The best guys are flying on those planes with him, and they're making all these televisions and giving those fans at home the best wrestling they probably could have. He's flying so much that I talked to his son, Roy Lee, about this in preparation for this show. Roy Lee says that Lester flew in a 5-year period of time. He spent 1.5 years on his plane. That means he's logging more hours than any commercial pilot anywhere in the world. He is just flying his rear end off, and he's become one of the best pilots in the world. Now, later on, as my podcasts go down, I'm going to have a lot of stories about flying with Lester, and they are phenomenal stories. Some of the best stories I have are flights on small planes, and Lester is a really, really great pilot, and I'll get to that in the future. Herb, Roy's other brother, that's pretty much Roy's age, he's still wrestling. He's still out there. He's still competing and has recently, within the last 5 years, still held the World Junior Heavyweight Championship. So he's cranked, and he's beginning now to train wrestlers, young wrestlers. One of them I'm going to mention by name that people are going to recognize probably all over the world is David Schultz, Dr. D. David Schultz. He's trained by Herb. One guy. I'm pretty sure that it may be that Honky Tonk Man is also trained by Herb. I'll try to find out that for sure before we go further into that. But that gives you an idea of where everybody is. We're obviously in Atlanta. It's mid-60s, and Dad is getting his thing cranked up into Atlanta. Let's just go around the United States and cover some of the major territories and who's in charge and what's happening. Up in the Northeast, you still got Vince Sr., Vince McMahon Sr., WWF it is at this point. Obviously, he's got great talent. He's operating a good part of the Northeast and some of the major markets in the country. In Florida, you've got Eddie Graham, who's now been there for a while. He's been involved in business with Cowboy Luttrell. Cowboy Luttrell was a big star there in the 40s and 50s, and his day is just about done, and Eddie is coming into his own, and he's making his presence known in Florida. I don't think he has taken over in 1965, but very shortly, he is going to become the man in the state of Florida with Florida Championship Wrestling. He's got Gordon Solie doing his television program. You don't have to say much more than that. If you want to talk the best, there is one of the best commentators in all of wrestling. So he is destined for big business, and he's already there, and they're already doing great in all these territories. You've got San Francisco. You've got Roy Shires still out there. Roy Shires is kicking butt. He's got Ray Stevens. He's got great talent out there. California is a totally different entity. You've got the promotion there. You've got the promotion in the Olympic Auditorium in Los Angeles. Those guys down, you got John Tolis there. And you've got guys like that that are big name stars that are cranking it for them out there on the West Coast and doing big business. Indiana, you got Dick the Bruiser. This whole part of the country up here, Indiana and Chicago, Detroit, a lot of those areas were under Jim Barnett's tutelage and owned by Jim Barnett. Jim Barnett is about to go to Australia. He's about to leave the United States and go to a continent. He's going to have his own continent to operate business on, and he's going to rock it for him when he gets to Australia. There's no doubt about that. But he's going to be replaced in Indianapolis by Dick the Bruiser. He's going to be replaced in Ohio and in that area by the Sheik. And she is going to rocket business as well, become a national star himself, like Dick the Bruiser does. They're going to do great business in Ohio. Houston, you got Paul Bosch. He's a fixture down there. He's a tremendous guy who has a fabulous reputation around the wrestling business, very well respected, and just keeps cranking out business, running stars in and out of there constantly. Jose Lothario is going in there now, who used to be in Arizona with Dad in the early 60s. He's now worked his way into Houston. He's going to train Shawn, as an example. Lothario would train Shawn Michaels, who was going to become a star in the WWE. You've got Vern. You go to Vern Gagne, you talk about the AWA up in the Minnesota area. From Minnesota, predominantly he's in the Minnesota area during this time frame in the early 60s and the mid 60s. And later on, after this is finished, he will proceed to the west. He will expand his territory to Denver and out west and pick up a lot of major cities that he's not in now. He's in his infancy. He's got great talent. He has a great concept of what wrestling is all about because he's been such a great amateur, wrestled in the Olympics. He is a perfect guy to run that company and to run that business, and he's going to rocket things. They're just going to have phenomenal success. Oregon, you're going to have Don Owens in Oregon, and he'll be out there. In Oklahoma, you've got Leroy McGirt, been there for a long time, blind gentleman who doesn't need eyes to see what takes to make wrestling business work. He sits there and watches those matches, and he can tell you who is over and who's not over by just listening to it. And he's already beginning to make inroads into Louisiana. Shreveport and Monroe, Louisiana are going to become Leroy McGurk's towns. He's eventually going to buy Lee Fields and the Fields brothers out of Louisiana. And later on, Bill Watts will come there and explode that company. Oklahoma and Louisiana, he will have these mega events in the Superdome in New Orleans as an example. History is going to be made by McGurk and the Oklahoma Territory. Carolina. Let's talk about the Carolinas. There's a guy there named Jim Crockett Sr. He's been there since the beginning. He has sons. They are very talented. They don't wrestle, but they are talented guys, and they understand the business, and they're going to follow in his footsteps. They're going to take that business way, way beyond where it is at this point. I got a story for you. I think this is a kind of a little different one. In the southern part of the United States, the southern promoters used to get together and have a meeting. You would have Roy and Nick out of the Tennessee territory, and the meetings were oftentimes held in Charlotte because Jim Crockett Sr. had been there a long time. He was very well respected as well. So Roy and Nick would fly from Nashville to Charlotte. Eddie Graham would come out of Florida and go to Charlotte. Dad would represent Georgia and fly into Charlotte. The Fields brothers would send a representative. Those major, Fred Ward, that had a part of the Georgia operation, he would come. So you had 8 or 10 very influential wrestling promoters sitting around a conference table. And those meetings, my dad told me a story one time, and I'll never forget this one. Nick Gulas, that was partners with Roy, my grandfather, he liked to show off. He had an ego. And he sat at the table one time. Dad said that he got up and said, you know, I got something here I want to show you guys. Have you ever seen one of these before? And he pulled out $1,000 bill out of his pocket. And he, you know, everybody, well, you know, he's sitting at a table with guys that can afford $1,000 bills. They could all have $1,000 bill in their pocket. But he's acting like, you know, I'm a big wheel here, bigger than you guys are. I guess he's trying to make a statement. And he passes around. He said, would you all like to see it? And he passes around the $1,000 bill. And then he goes around the table. And Dad's sitting at the end of the table. And he watches it pass around. And the guys just take a look at it, you know, and they pass it to the next guy. And when it comes to Dad, he takes the $1,000 bill and he looks at it and says, yeah, that's really something. And he takes it and he tears it in half. So Nick goes, "Oh gosh, man, oh Lord, your $1,000 bill, you just ruined it." You know, well, obviously he could still get the bill replaced, but it was just Nick's attitude and Dad's little playful attitude. Well, this means nothing, you know. So it was a group of guys across the United States that were all running these companies and all had great talent, all had great programs, all had great ideas. They had great bookers, and they're all doing great business. You got Muchnick in St. Louis, president of the National Wrestling Alliance. You got Bob Geigel and guys like that that are going to be in Kansas City and going to be running operations in this midsection of the country. Arlie Race is becoming a star there. The company and the business and the industry is just really rocking.
Stud, when they're sitting in that room in Charlotte and they're all meeting, as you paint that picture, and I can't help but think about just a few years earlier, all those mob godfathers up in Apalachin when they had their meeting and they would have their these clandestine locations. And these guys all get together in a room. Did your pop tell you, do they trade ideas there? Do they talk about what's popping this territory or working in that territory? Or, hey, you ought to do this with so-and-so. Or, hey, you ought to develop this character over here. Or you ought to play off this that's currently going on in pop culture or whatever it is. Do they share ideas in that room?
Yeah, you always did. And they did the same thing at the National Wrestling Alliance meetings because you had more promoters there. You had them from all over the world that came there. And that's part of why you came. You wanted to meet everybody. You wanted to be seen there. You wanted to be in that atmosphere. But it was a teaching. It was where you got educated. I was part of the NWA when I did my first company in Knoxville. And I couldn't wait to those meetings. They were every August in Las Vegas. And you'd go out there and spend 4 days. And I'd come out of there with so many new ideas. And at the same time, there were occasions when they would invite me to come up and talk to them about television because I was doing some things that weren't being done in their areas. And they would set up different individuals to come up in front of everybody and tell them what they were doing. And everybody shared that knowledge. It made a better product. And they not only shared the knowledge of what they were doing, they also shared the knowledge of who was in their territories and who they would like to get. And you had an opportunity to talk to Stu Hart as an example. And he had the Mongolian Stomper in Calgary, Canada. So, you know, I wanted Stomper. I saw the huge impact he would make for me in the eastern part of Tennessee. And so we would talk, and he would say, "Who do you have?" I had a lot of young talent. Dick Slater, Bob Orton Jr., Ronnie Garvin. I mean, there was a lot of talent that I had that he was interested in. So you did business with other promoters. Yeah, you took every opportunity that you had to improve your situation and improve your status and improve your product. And that's exactly what these meetings were set up to do. That's what they were designed to do.
It's really interesting stuff, man, to hear you talk about the territory system back then. Because again, we're in 1965. Wrestling is so vibrant from coast to coast. And who knows where you could get these totals, but it would be really interesting to see how many people, I'm talking about total people now, in different folks, in 1 month's time, go to see live professional wrestling. And then all the terrific, high-quality stuff that you would have had available to you within a 100-mile drive, like nightly territory stuff if you were a fan back then, and you could afford to go from town to town, how much great stuff you could have seen. Just a thought for you.
Yeah, it would have been a great trip. I would have loved to have been doing that as a young guy at that age and in that time. I'd have loved to have gotten a car and went right across the country and stopped in every promotion and stopped and saw the talent and see the matches and see the impact they were having on everybody. And it was a thriving and huge business, just really, really big. You know, if you want to take a break, let's take our break. And I want to come back and I want to take us around the world now. I want to go outside the United States and start covering some areas that people may have very little knowledge about. I know we've got a tremendous amount of fans, Tony. It's amazing to me where our fans are. England is red hot for wrestling, and England is cranking us. We have so many fans in England, I'm amazed by it. Australia is still a big market for wrestling. India, we're getting Germany, letters and comments from people literally all over the world, and I want to see if I can touch base so that they, you know, they may not know who was there in 65, what they were doing in 1965, and that's why I like to do these segments. I'm not going to do these very often, but every once in a while, I would like to take us worldwide and just bring everybody up to date about who's where and what's happening.
We are doing exactly that, hitting the reset button today on Episode 21 of your Studcast, 96 years, four generations. And if you would like to learn more about your Tennessee Stud, or you'd like to reach out and contact the Tennessee Stud, you can do so. Facebook, Ron Fuller Tennessee Stud is where you find him. Again, Ron Fuller Tennessee Stud, all spelled out. Go to the website, tnstud.com. Hit the stud up on Instagram or Twitter, at Ron Fuller Welch. We'll come back and we'll throw it to the great David Summers. We'll come back. We'll get back into this. We're going to go global. We're going to go worldwide as the movement we call the Studcast continues right after this.
The Tennessee Stud loves Christmas and has created a special commemorative Christmas offer for you, someone in your family, or any stud fan. Give a stud gift this Christmas for the first time. Ride over to the website at tnstud.com. That's tnstud.com. And click on the stud store. Find a great gift idea in the photo section. We all know photos make a great Christmas present. So how about your choice of one or more of the four 8x10 glossy photos available there? Have them personally autographed to whomever you choose with Merry Christmas 2017 if you like. And they're all signed by the Tennessee Stud himself. This commemorative photo will be a one-of-a-kind collector's item and a very special gift. Or maybe someone you know would love to have the classic Stud Cast t-shirt in black or the new blue on Christmas morning. Give your loved ones or yourself something really different this Christmas. This special commemorative Christmas offer must be ordered on the website only at tnstud.com before December 19th to ensure delivery by Christmas Eve. This offer will continue if ordered by January 1st, 2018. From all of us here at the Studcast in Studland, we appreciate your support, and we wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Don't forget, tnstud.com. That's tnstud.com. You are back, seated ringside, on this edition of the Ron Fuller Studcast.
And we welcome you back on the Studcast, your Tennessee Studcast, featuring your Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. As I was telling you, episode 21. It's hard for me to believe that we've been doing this heading into the 5-month mark. It's crazy. Time flies and you're having fun. Stud, as we were saying before you left, you were wanting to get global here and set the global scene for us in 1965 as far as wrestling goes. We have folks all over the world who I'm sure will find this interesting, a snapshot some 53 years ago. Or 52 years ago, Stud laid on me.
All right. Let's start with England. I mentioned it earlier, I think, what's going on in England. What's going on in England nowadays is pretty amazing. They're experiencing a revival of the popularity of the sport in England. Back in 1965, they had a national program that developed there. It was called World of Sport Wrestling. It took England, it just catapulted their business around England. There are various promoters. England is a big country, and there are various promoters at that time in all parts of England, has been. And people need to realize that it's that way all over the country and all over the world, that you don't just have one promoter. United States, that's more that situation because of the National Wrestling Alliance. They're pretty much all involved, and they have these areas in which they basically do business, and everybody knows that they do business. In other parts of the world, there's a lot more competition there. Now, that's good and bad. I mean, it can be good because you've got a lot of different wrestlers and you've got a lot of different places you can go and see wrestling. But the content of what you see and the performers that you see are probably not as good as if you have a one product and they go out and find the best they can find for you, put those people on television for you, and bring them to your arena to see the live event. That's happening all over the world. It has from the beginning of professional wrestling, which I think my time frame is somewhere around 1900. That's the predominant way that business is operated with the territories. Some countries have a lot of territories. Some countries have a limited number of territories. In England, there are a lot of people that are involved in running it. But then wrestling, the World of Sport wrestling show comes, and that kind of jams it all into one. It's run by one organization. It's on twice a week. It's on Saturday, and it's on late night during the week. People are watching it, huge audiences. Now, the stars are, oddly enough, Adrian Street. Adrian Street is a young guy. Adrian Street becomes a star for me in Southeastern Wrestling in Pensacola and in Continental. I get him out of England in 1983, probably 84. Adrian comes to America, his first time in America, and he sends me videos, and we talk on the phone for 2 months about Adrian coming to America. He's a huge star in England. In 65, he is a young guy, and he is Adrian Street's a character. And for those that don't know Adrian Street, you need to look him up. You need to Google Adrian Street because he is different. That's all I want to say about him. He is very, very different. You had Adrian Street. You got a guy named Mick McManus, who was a big star then. Dynamite Kid. Dynamite Kid was a big star in more than one country, in other countries as well. Kendo Nagasaki, Japanese that got over in England and stayed there, made a career out of it. Haystacks Calhoun. They call him Giant Haystacks. That's Haystacks Calhoun, who has made trips in the United States and probably most territories. He was a star in the realm of Gorgeous George Jr., in which you could book Haystacks on your card just about anywhere in the country, and people would come to see him. For one reason, he weighed about 500 pounds. He was a huge, huge man, and he was just as big a star in England as he was in America. So they got it cranked in England. This is 1965. They are doing gangbuster business. Now, they're going to pretty soon lose that national television program, and it's going to disintegrate a little bit back into the old style where you've got a lot of independent promotions, but its power and its capacity to draw people and to draw money is going to diminish significantly without that national program. Let's talk about Australia. We spoke about it before the break. Jim Barnett's going to Australia. Australia, there are guys there, Ron Miller and Larry O'Day. There are Aussie guys that have been there for a long, long time. And my experience going there in 1971 for the first time, going back in 73 for 3 months, I have a real feel for Australia. And Australia is, it's a fabulous wrestling market. They love their wrestling in Australia. There is no national program. You've got a bunch of different televisions, just like in the United States. You've got a Sydney TV. You've got a Melbourne TV. You've got an Adelaide TV. You've got a Brisbane TV. So you've got all these movable parts and pieces that you have to get wrestlers from one place to another in Australia quickly to be able to support all these television programs. They are doing great business. They are going to continue to do great business. He's smart, Jim Barnett. He brings in wrestlers from all over the world. He takes advantage of Mario Milano for the Italians and Spiros Arion for the Greeks and Sabu Singh for the people from India. He's got it working, and it's going to be big, and it's going to get bigger after this time frame. It's going to even grow beyond that. All Japan. In Japan, you have All Japan only at this point. That's Baba. New Japan with Inoki is just about to pop onto the scene. And Japan is going to have two competing companies doing wrestling in Japan. Inoki is going to become a huge star in Japan because he's going to eventually work a boxer against wrestler match in Japan that will draw a huge, monstrous crowd. It'll be a worldwide event against Muhammad Ali. So Inoki will wrestle against Muhammad Ali, who will box. They've had those kind of events before, but that is going to put New Japan on the radar. That match is going to make New Japan a bona fide contender to compete with All Japan. All Japan is run by Baba, is 7 foot Jap. I mean, Japanese at 7 feet are just not unheard of. And he has a huge body. So you've got two Japanese organizations run by two great figures, Baba and Inoki. And they're going to collide. Those companies are going to collide for the next few years. But they are both going to survive. They're going to do well, and that's very unusual to have two promotions against one another. Both do well. They're going to flourish. They're going to do well. Let's cover Canada. Vancouver, you got Cliff Parker out there, and he's going to be followed by Gene Koninsky. They run a big operation out there. Wrestling in western part of the United States and in western Canada is different than when you move east of the Rockies. The style changes, and it's pretty amazing that there's two different styles on one side of the Rockies than there is on another, but that is the case there. Calgary, you got Stu Hart there. Stu Hart is one of the most remarkable characters that I ever met in wrestling. I used to go to the National Wrestling Alliance meetings, and I would talk to him. He would always come to me because, as mentioned earlier, I talked to him about Mongolian Stomper, about Archie. And Archie came to wrestle for me eventually in Tennessee, became a monster star. And Stu would go, how's Archie doing? He had this strange voice and a strange style of talking. I always really appreciated him. He is another person that, like the Welches, produced a lot of family members. I got a couple of great stories. I just want to throw in one story about Archie here, that about Stu. And the Funks told me this story. We were in Japan, and Junior and Terry were sitting eating someplace, and they said, Ron, we used to go up there and work Stampede in Calgary with Stu. And they said, we'd stay at his house. And he said, we would eat breakfast with him one morning. And he said, Stu was cooking us eggs, and we're in the kitchen. And he said, they had a lot of cats, and the cats were running around on the floor and everything. And he says, the Stu's got this little spatula, and he's flipping the eggs. And a cat walks between them and Stu and stops and poops in the floor right there behind Stu. And Stu's talking to him, and he's going to get there. You know, he said, that guy was doing such and such. And he looks, he turns around, and he sees the cat poop on the floor. And he flips the egg, and he reaches down there with the spatula, and he scoops up the cat poop. And he pushes the screen door open and flips it out there. And he goes, got this stinging cat's been there. He said he went right back and started flipping the eggs again. So Stu Hart, he had a long table. He's got the big family. He got all those kids. He got Brett, and he's got Owen. He's got all those boys, and he's sitting at his long table. In the old days, they had the old stores where you had shelves that were up real high, and they had a long pole. They had a little thing that you pulled at the bottom of it, and a little claw thing on the top so that you could reach up there and pick items off the top parts of a shelf. He had that laying by their wall in his dining room. They're having dinner. Terry Jr. says, one of the boys down at the far end of the table starts to create some commotion, and Stu can't get to him. And Stu goes, hey, get the shut up down there, you know. And Owen or Brett or whichever one it was, they just kept going. And he reached over and he got the long pole, and he raised it up and lowered it right around the kid's neck, whoever one it was, and pulled the lever on it, like to tighten it on it, and then flipped him backwards in his chair and landed up against the wall. You shut up, I told you, God, guy, you know. It's characters, man. So many characters in wrestling. There's one of the classics of all time, Stu Hart in Calgary.
I love the cat dirt, especially with the way my stomach hurts today as we record our studcast. I really appreciate that, Stud. Thanks, man. My stomach's a little weak, and I appreciate you sharing that with me. And I'm already got sort of the dry heaves going over here, but that's okay. I just hope it's not catching here in our Knoxville studio. That's all I can say to you. But, Stud, you're making me ill with that kind of conversation. One word about Adrian Street. Now, I was looking that up while you were talking because I said to myself, there's no way the guy who was with you in Continental was wrestling in 1965, so I look it up on Mr. Searchy. And what do I find? Adrian Street was born 1940, which means that when he wrestles for you, in the mid-80s, let's say 85. He's 45 years old there. Now, Adrian Street, along with Miss Linda, that man does not look like a 45-year-old man wrestling for you. What a physical specimen.
No way. I didn't know what year he was born in, but you darn right. I mean, that sucker was still in shape. And you know, Adrian Street was a shooter. Adrian knew how to do it. He had a strange, he was a strange individual, and he sold himself quite differently than most people. And he used to love to sing, and he would record all these songs, and we would use them for his intro. And one of his favorite songs was, "Just Imagine What I Could Do to You." I mean, he had this strange voice, and he was a strange guy. Now, I had no idea he was that old. I would have thought he was 30 years old. He had the body of a 30-year-old.
Yeah, I'm a vinyl collector, and I have Adrian Street's album in the other room in my collection. I found it at one of these old antique shops, and I came across it, and it's an autographed copy, autographed by Adrian and also Miss Linda. And I put it on one day just to listen to it. And, Stud, I hope you didn't have anything to do with that, because literally that's some of the worst music I've ever heard.
I had nothing to do with it. And I used to laugh. He would send me these specials. He would do these specials, and he'd have matches in the background, and he'd have his voice singing over the matches. And I was like, well, the matches are fabulous, but the voice and the song is terrible. But you couldn't separate the two, so I'd go ahead and air them. I spent months promoting him before he ever came to America. He loved Pensacola. In fact, he's there today. Since we're talking about Adrian, he is going back to England right now. I think he's leaving this month. He spent years there. He came there in probably 83, 84, and he spent all those years, and he's going back home to England. So funny we got on to Adrian here, but Adrian's quite a character.
Oh, I can imagine. And I can imagine in the mid-80s there, down in the Continental Territory, you're talking about in that neck of the woods. I'd imagine some of those country boys, and shall we say rednecks, probably tried him and probably didn't like it when they tried it, Stud.
Oh, no. No, I mean, he was salty. He was salty, and he knew his stuff. And word gets around in the wrestling business among wrestlers who's good and who's not, who knows and who doesn't know. And everybody knew, and Adrian knew, and he came from Wigan. He's out of Wigan, and Wigan, England, it's renowned for shooters. There was a lot of great shooters that are out of that Wigan area. So he was a phenomenal talent. Real quickly, I want to finish Canada here, and then we move into questions. Toronto, real quickly, you got the Tunnies there. You know, you got Frank and Gene. They're stars, and they do a phenomenal job. That's one of the best drawing cities in all of Canada. Montreal, you've got Johnny Rougeau, and they're battling the Vachon. You got the Vachons there, the brothers, and the Rougeaus, and you know from the Johnny Rougeau comes Jacques Rougeau and his brother. So it's a family business up there in Montreal, but they're still doing great. And the Maritimes over there on the East Coast, you got Al Zink, who's there and been there for quite a while, and he's really running a good operation. Back in those days, you had Les Thatcher and Ken Lucas that were spending time in the Maritimes. He was using a lot of wrestlers out of America to expand his product and to expand his reach for people that were there. You've got everywhere around the world. It's just cranked up. Wrestling is just dynamite and just doing great business. And it's going to stay that way until Vince comes, until Vince Jr. comes. It's going to be amazing.
Stud, it's been amazing so far. Let's get to some questions. Alan Moore out of Russville, Georgia. It's Russville, Georgia, by the way. Alan, I want to get that right. If you want to ask the Stud a question before we get completely immersed in this, go to tnstud.com. I encourage you to click on the website. You'll hear the Stud talk about that website momentarily. Also, Facebook, Ron Fuller, Tennessee Stud, all spelled out on Facebook. Instagram and Twitter, you can find Ron at Ron Fuller Welch. Again, Ron Fuller Welch. Alan Moore, Russville, Georgia, asked the following. I've often wondered why you only ran USA Wrestling for 6 months. It was great. Why so short, Ron?
Oh, that's a good question. A lot of people probably don't know. I had my first wrestling company with Southeastern Wrestling in Knoxville. I built a second company while I still owned the first one. It was Southeastern Wrestling based out of Pensacola, Florida. Changed the names of that company in Pensacola to Continental Wrestling in 1983. Operated that to 1988. And in early 1988, I started my last wrestling company back in Knoxville called USA Wrestling. Gordon Solie was my commentator. It was a great little program. I had some really great talent. Bob Armstrong and his sons, Brad, back in that day. Scott was just starting. Had a great group of wrestlers. Johnny Rich, Buddy Landell, Ron Wright, Mongolian Stomper. Great group of wrestlers, and I basically quit for two reasons, I think, probably. I only ran it for 6 months. I really saw Vince, now it's 1988, I saw Vince, that's why I sold my Continental to David Woods, is because I felt like the wrestling had seen its day and that Vince was going to make these changes that were going to be unparable, and it wasn't going to go backward. It was going in that direction. It was going to stay that way. So I felt like it was time to get out. And that's basically what I did. I was thinking about other things too. After this, I'm going to wait for about a year and try to figure out after I close down USA what I'm going to do. And I, oddly enough, come up with the strangest. I go in a totally different direction than I've ever gone. And I get involved in hockey. So I end up in hockey with minor league teams. And so my life changes dramatically. That's a good question from Alan. I think it's his name. You know, and that's kind of why it only lasted for 6 months. I kind of saw the end of it coming. And I also had the same gentleman that bought Continental approach me and said, I want to buy this company. And so I sold it. That's how that all ended.
It was a great product. I know that. The footage that's online that survived of that time period, that was some really great stuff, the way you were presenting the sport, especially against what Vince McMahon was doing at the time. Let's move along here. Gabe Lopez, Elizabethtown, New Jersey, wants to know the following. Did Roy ever talk to you about the death of Eddie Baker, which happened in the ring against him in 1937?
Roy never talked to me about this. And I don't know why, but I didn't know about this. I'll be quite honest with you. I didn't know. It'd be strange that this question pops up here because someone sent me something 2 weeks ago about this very thing. And it was a short write-up. This match took place in Corinth, Mississippi in 1937. And Eddie Baker died in the ring during the match. Two things were odd to me about the little story that was in the paper there. And one was they had 800 people in Corinth, Mississippi in 1937. Now, I'm thinking that, wow, that's a pretty darn good crowd for a small town in the northern part of Mississippi. I'll bet you back in those days, Corinth, Mississippi's population was in the 1930s, the late 30s, I would say maybe 10,000. Maybe 10,000 people. That'd be great to know what that figure is. That got to me. And then the fact that, and then the article in the paper that I read said that Eddie Baker stopped moving, that the crowd booed because he was no longer moving. Now, Roy pinned him. I assume he pinned him at that point. What else is he going to do? And they counted him out. And the crowd booed, and someone called, they got on the PA, and Roy must have got up and went over and said, you know, we need a doctor here. And they got on the PA and said, is there a doctor in the house? A doctor was there. He crawled into the ring, and he pronounced him dead in the ring. That's a kind of an amazing thing to have happen. Deaths in the ring from wrestling are a lot more prevalent than you believe. And next week, I want to go back to Georgia again, and we're going to talk about death in the ring in Savannah, Georgia, of one of the greats, the all-time greats from back in my granddad's day, a guy named Tex Riley. And there's going to be a second death in the ring in Savannah, Georgia, years after that, that's going to change the history of wrestling in Atlanta forever. So I'll just give you that little teaser for next week, but I'm amazed at the story. Having read it, I probably wouldn't have known about it. And if I hadn't known about it, I would definitely have asked Roy how that all went down and what happened. But he never volunteered any of that to me. And if I hadn't seen this article, I might not even have known about it.
As I hunt the population for Corinth, Mississippi, and I'm doing exactly that, and I'm actually semi-offended that I haven't found it as of now, because I I'm pretty damn good at this, generally speaking. Stud, what's the worst somebody's ever been injured with you in the ring, and how impactful is it when one of your opponents gets hurt, whether it's of your volition or not?
It's very impactful. I've had guys break their legs. I've had some very bad injuries of my own. And what happens when you get hurt, it shows what kind of guts you have. At that point, I blew out my knee with Michael Hayes in Mobile, Alabama, probably 1983, horribly. I went through the ropes and landed wrong on my right leg, and it popped. It sounded like a shotgun. Somebody had shot off a shotgun in the building. The crowd went totally silent, and I got up. I knew I was done. And I crawled back through the ropes, and you try to do what you have to do or do what you can. It's very difficult to keep going when you've got an opponent that can't go anymore. You see all kinds of different injuries. I mean, you know, broken legs and then knees, and, you know, sometimes it's facial injuries and, you know, guy's nose gets broke, whatever it may be, and a lot of blood. It tests you as to what type of person you are and how you're going to handle things.
Our panel is telling me congratulations to Alan Moore, Brussville, Georgia, who asked the question about USA Wrestling. Personally, I liked Gabriel's question better regarding that rather morbid subject of the death of Eddie Baker. And by the way, Stud, you said there were how many people at that match? Because I've got the population for Corinth, Mississippi at the time. How many people at the match, Stud?
Article said 800 people.
6,220 is the population of that place. So if 800 people are there and 6,000 is the population of that place, that's a pretty high concentration of your folks in one spot. In one night.
I think that's why when I read the article, that figure stuck out, because I've wrestled. I actually had my second match in my life in Corinth, Mississippi in 1968, and it couldn't have been 10,000 people then. So I knew it had to be a small population back in those days, and pretty amazing that you draw 800 people in 1937. That's just at the tail end of the Depression. We weren't really out of it probably even then.
Stud, we're about to take it home here on this edition of your Studcast. Any final thoughts from you, my friend?
Just been great. I mean, obviously, I want to thank everybody. Phenomenal what we're doing here now, and what our audience is it's remarkable. We have become one of the biggest wrestling podcasts in the country and in the world. And we've got all these people listening from all around the world. And, you know, I'd like to, at the end, you know, remind people that, you know, if you would like to support us and you'd like to donate to what we do here and like to help ensure that we're going to have this on for years down the road and be able to finish the story, my family's story. And that's what I got in this for. That's what I really want to do. You know, you're welcome to donate to us. You can go to tnstud.com and click on donate and make a contribution to us. It's a minimum of $5, which is a very small amount. Or you can donate as much as you want and as often as you want. Or you don't have to donate at all. You know, if you don't feel comfortable with that, that's fine with us. You know, we don't want you to know that it's available. You can go to Patreon, patreon.com/studcast, and make a contribution there or a donation there. And we certainly appreciate those that contribute and those that donate. And we appreciate those that don't just as well, because everybody is welcome here. And you'll never have to pay for this Studcast that we do on a weekly basis here. That's not going to happen. So we're going to be here to keep doing what we do. I love it. I know you enjoy it too, Tony, just as much as I do. And it's just a pleasure to be here and to ride that horse every week. And I'm going to take him back to the barn now, and I'm going to wet him down and get a blanket on him tonight. I'll be ready to roll come next week.
21 episodes, Stud. It's unbelievable. And so generous of you to split that money with me on a 75-25 split. 75 coming this way. And it's just wonderful of you, Stud, to pay out generously toward me. Because I must say, I've done 75% of the work today. So.
Well, you do a lot of good stuff, Tony. And you got those fast fingers, man. You came up with that car anth information. I thought you probably would, you know. So it's just a pleasure working with you. It's a pleasure doing this program to all people around the world that are listening to this. I just thank you so much, and I'm humbled by it. I can't wait to be back here and sitting in this chair next week.
Hey, Stud, like any man who's been married 26 years, you develop fast hands.
Yeah. Good.
No comment from the Stud. All right, Stud, on the way out, I want to remind you, if you want to get in touch with the Tennessee Stud, you can do so on its website, tnstud.com. Stud was just telling you about that. Any Patreon contributions would be greatly appreciated, all juvenile humor aside. Also, Facebook, Ron Fuller, Tennessee Stud. Instagram and Twitter, Ron Fuller Welch. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, you can find me at Tony Basilio. Also, my website, TonyBasilio.com. I've got some great interviews on my site as well. If you check out my book corner, different subjects, if you enjoy the history and some of the stuff you've heard here, I've got some things there that might be right up your alley. In the meantime, Stud, a lot of fun, man. Thanks, brother, for having me along.
Oh, thank you very much, Tony, and thanks for being here with me. I think we do it as a team, and let's just keep it rolling.
David Summers, take it home, my friend. The Tennessee Stud. We're going to come back on episode 22 and ride, baby, ride once again until we meet again. For the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, this is Tony Basilio wishing you a great week. Spread the word on your Studcast.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction. For another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains. This Studcast is distributed by Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network.